Hi, this is Lori, your host of Happiness Hangout, a space to come and elevate your happiness levels. You, me, and our guests will discuss and help you apply happiness to all aspects of your life, even if you're already happy. Get your daily boost of information to help you feel your best. Welcome, Kim Langley, speaker, trainer, coach, and president of Life Balance Enterprises, here to talk with us today about optimism. Kim has been in the field of emotional intelligence for over 20 years and has studied and taught optimism to many individuals and organizations. Hey, Kim, and welcome to the Happiness Hangout. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Lori.
Great. Well, I'm just going to launch right into this. I've been very curious about the topic of optimism. As you know, I work with the topic of happiness and I throw well-being in there as well. And I think our audience would be interested to know, what are the differences and similarities between optimism and happiness?
Well, that's a good question. Optimism is certainly a competence of happiness. There are very few truly happy, profoundly pessimistic people out there. And so it's a good thing for people to at least take a look at their optimism skills and make sure that they're present. But they're not, of course, the same thing, because optimism is a little bit of a mixed bag. And what I mean by that is I'm sure all your listeners are familiar with the positive psychology movement. And the positive psychology movement involves a lot of folks who are researching, you know, let's look at people who are happy and healthy and living long lives and see what they do and teach the rest of us. And one of the things that's been found is that optimism is a characteristic of people who live pretty happy, healthy, long lives. But there's also some downsides to optimism, because what some people call optimism, other people might say is delusional. And so researchers on optimism have been careful to, like Martin Seligman, for example, who's one of the gurus of optimism and who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania in Philly. He likes to talk about authentic optimism. You know, optimism that provides the benefits but not the downside of a kind of rose-colored glasses approach to life. Mm-hmm. So you can see how if you have healthy optimism, where you are a hopeful person generally, but you still aren't afraid to look at the worst-case scenario and make plans for it, that might lead to a happier life.
Okay, that kind of makes it a little clearer to me, because I have to laugh, and I'm not looking for an answer here, but I took an optimism test, okay? Mm-hmm. I took one, and I think it was through Dr. Seligman, yes. And I was shocked. I only came out moderately optimistic, but yes. When I take some of his assessments on happiness, I come out very high. And I was very shocked by that. So, yes. Again, I'm not looking for an answer as to why. I just was kind of surprised by it.
Well, actually, I can speak to that a little bit. And before I do that, let me tell our listeners that if they'd like to hear a little bit about the research on what's called the optimism bias, and that is the tendency of human brains to always think that nothing will happen to them. You know, people underestimate the possibility of just about everything, getting sick, having enough money for retirement, getting hit by a car, and so on. So the optimism bias is actually one of the things that gives optimism a bad name for people who are realists, because they see people not preparing for their future adequately because they're rose-colored glasses people. And mm-hmm. There's a very nice TED Talk by, her name is Tali, I'm not sure how you say the last name, but it's Sharot. And she's been researching the optimism bias for years. So before I go on and sing the praises of optimism, I want to just put that out there as part of my due diligence. All right, now Great. Back to your thing about why do those scores come out the way they do. And, of course, I invite our listeners to get online and take Dr. Seligman's assessment, because it's very motivating, especially if you get a low score, to take a look at, well, how should I be talking to myself in ways that will increase that healthy, or as he says, authentic optimism. So what he's measuring in his optimism test is what he calls explanatory style. How do I explain things to myself when they happen? And if I have a tendency to explain things as if they're permanent, personal, and pervasive when they're bad things, then I really steer myself in the direction of pessimism. So true dyed-in-the-wool pessimists are the people who will say, everything happens to me, and of course that wasn't going to go right. So they take a little thing and they make, as our grandparents who didn't have the research but were pretty smart sometimes said, they make a mountain out of a molehill. And some people do this like every minute of every day, which can lead to a lot of misery. An example would be many people in their upbringings. My own was full of love, but I had a grandma who was quite pessimistic in her speech, and of course I learned that. That went on to my mental chip from hearing her all the time. So she was one of those, you know, bad things come in threes, and you're all laughing now, but soon somebody will be crying. You know, she said that to me when we were kids, and I've laughed.
I got that too. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have. That's one of the things that I've learned over the years as a speaker and trainer, that we are not alone, Lori. So, of course, you know, when I was young, that's how I thought. So one day I'm rushing out of the house, and I have, you know, my briefcase and my purse and a kid by the hand, and I'm going on my way to give a keynote, and so I'm suited up, and I spill my coffee down the front of my shirt. And so right away my brain kicks into, why did this have to happen to me? I can't believe I did this, you know, kind of verbally beating yourself up. All this permanent, personal, and pervasive overtones to an event that's actually nothing, you know, spill coffee on yourself. So because I was learning optimism skills at the time, I heard myself say, oh, it's going to be a bad day. And I stopped myself, which is what our listeners might want to consider doing. I kind of trained myself to hold up a mental stop sign and say, girlfriend, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. Why would you want to predict a bad day already? It doesn't even make any sense. Go in the house, throw the shirt in a bucket and soak it till you get home, put on something else, and go have a good day. And apparently, this is what optimists are really good at, or get better and better at. They choose not to grind away at the badness of things. And they choose to remember that difficult things are often temporary, while at the same time, you know, being able to prepare for difficulties or walk right up to problems and solve them.
That makes more sense now of what the differences are, because I can see that. I personally do that. I will stop myself from doing what you just said. Say, oh, there it is. The program is running, in other words.
Yes,
and
exactly.
I think a lot of people, our listeners, can probably relate to that.
Well, Seligman himself is fascinating to read about or to you know, watch him on YouTube, because he describes himself as a dyed-in-the-wool pessimist. And here in the end, he's researching optimism for over 40 years. And one of his big turning points was when his little daughter said something to him about, you know, he said this in an interview, geez, Daddy, you know, you always see the downside of things. She was about 5, and it just hit him like hit him in the head like a brick, you know. And he feels that he's become much more optimistic, appropriately, over the years. And he said if he could change, anybody can change. So we're not doomed by our upbringing or even by our genes, you know, to be pessimists. We can always bump ourselves up the scale a little bit toward more optimistic self-talk and approach to problems.
Well, you know, speaking of the, I wanted to tell our listeners that later on in the show, I am going to give them the information on how to take that optimism assessment. So if they want to see how they are and where that they are falling right now, they'll be able to do that. So we're going to get that later in the show.
Great.
So Kim, what happens if I'm just really down? And I don't feel like being optimistic. I just don't have it. Do you have any advice on where we might start? Where would you even start?
Well, you know, gosh, we could talk for hours about this, but everybody, one of the things we know now is that everybody has down days. I mean, there's hardly anyone who is so relentlessly optimistic that, you know, every day is full of laughter and joy. A lot of this is about choices. So it's pretty normal, the research shows, for people to have certain biorhythms where certain days they get out of bed, they just don't really feel like they have it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the good news, actually, because if we've all felt that way, we can be a little gentle with ourselves. On the other hand, most of us still have to go up to work and raise kids or, you know, be friendly with a partner or spouse. And, you know, you got to do what you got to do. So here's one study that has encouraged me, and I think our listeners will be interested in. Researchers asked, two groups of people to wear a little beepy device on their wrist that reminded them to monitor their mood every hour. And if I recall correctly, they picked a number to represent their mood on a scale of 1 to 10, and then also a word or a phrase that kind of described it. So everyone agrees that they'll do this, and half of the group gets their beeping thing in their little journal that they're going to keep track of all this in, and off they go for 2 weeks. The other half gets held behind for one additional instruction by the researchers, and that is, on the days when you feel kind of yucky getting up in the morning, act as if you feel better than you do. That was it. That was the whole additional instruction. So off they go to live for 2 weeks. And when they collected everyone's journals at the end and crunched up the numbers and made inferences from the words that they had chosen to describe their moods, they could tell that in the group where people didn't have that additional instruction, sometimes their bad or listless mood lasted until lunchtime, sometimes all afternoon, sometimes until they got home from work. And for a small percentage of the group, all day, they just were in a bad mood all day. But in the group that was instructed to act as if they felt better than they did, their bad mood days lifted on average 2 hours after they got up. And it's interesting that 2 hours is just enough time to, get up, get yourself ready, have your coffee, if you have a partner, greet them, and then go to work and start saying good morning to everybody. And we know now that there's a good bit of research that shows that our brain really eavesdrops on our body. So if I go to work and I'm looking down at the carpet and people are coming by me going, good morning, Kim, and I grunt at them, my brain hears that. It says, wow, we must really be having a bad day. Our shoulders are hunched. Our head is down. We're grunting, But if I put on my game face, so to speak, because I've decided that I'm going to bring my A game to life, whether I'm feeling it for the moment or not, as people in the recovery community say, fake it till you make it. And, boy, the research really bears that out. We can all be doing that. Then my brain, again, is eavesdropping on my body going, hey, look, we must be feeling better. Our head's up. We're standing up straight. We're smiling and nodding to everybody that we go by. Things are looking up.
And how many people? Well, how many people really do that? You have to put the game face on when you go to work. Most people do. Yeah. And when you put that game face on, you sort of just live in it, and maybe that's what happens. I mean, it sounds like from research.
You.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, it's awesome. And if I didn't mean to interrupt, Lori, did I?
No, not at all.
Okay. So, and the other thing is to pay attention to how you're greeting people. So those who grunt or don't say much are actually depriving themselves of an opportunity to do a little of that self-talk for themselves. So if someone asks me how I am and I say, just getting by, thank God it's Friday, look at what I'm telling myself. And I probably have an opportunity to do that 30 times a week or more. Why don't I say something like, great or grateful or, things are going well? I trained foster parents for over 20 years, and some of them have really taught me this. One foster parent who likes me, and so she comes to a lot of my classes, and she's got 7 kids in her house, and she and her husband are just awesome parents and really doing great things for some hurting kids. And when you say to her, how are you doing? She invariably says, too blessed to be stressed. I mean, what a great message to give yourself over and over
right. When
people casually inquire, how are you doing?
That's a good one. And, I know people that are around me mm-hmm. that are very, I would say, very pessimistic by nature, but they can be very happy, in which we know mm-hmm. some of the differences now. And the thing I'm wondering is, there are people out there who maybe don't even want to do it. They're just... Mm-hmm. They don't even want to do it. They don't even feel it. So I guess my question is optimism for everyone?
Well, it's fascinating. We certainly need people who are really good at predicting worst-case scenarios. So I would say authentic optimism, like true hopefulness, is a good thing for everyone. For one thing, optimists outlive pessimists in a boatload of studies. Optimists have fewer health problems. So there are definite reasons that, you know, you said, like, kind of take a look at your score when you get it. But I don't want our listeners to think that being optimistic means that you can't be realistic as well. In fact, the signature on my email is a quote from a poem by American poet Wendell Berry, and it is one of my guiding lights in life. And what it says is, be joyful, comma, though you have considered all the facts. And that's what I recommend. So when, you know, I've taught a lot of science of optimism workshops in corporations and healthcare and just all over. And usually when people really hate this stuff, they describe themselves as realists. But in fact, when you talk to them a little more or you look at their assessment, they're actually pessimists. So there are people who have learned that kind of optimism is for wimps. And it's hard for them to take seriously that this is something that's going to benefit them.
People don't want to come off sounding Pollyanna or pie in the sky. And it's funny you say this because I love to do the worst case scenario. And I usually do it and go, you know what? Whatever, that's not bad. Or I can do that. I can handle that. I'll immediately look at that and go, I can deal with that. So maybe that's, I don't know, is that optimism, pessimism mixed? Or is that somewhat of an optimist being real?
Yes, do you think? I would say the second. And then you would really be a realist if you said, sometimes, and maybe I'm not entirely prepared for that, and so therefore I am going to save a larger percentage of my paycheck, or, you know, the things that we need to do, I'm going to buy health insurance or life insurance. You know, some, it's not enough to just say I can cope with that. I don't imagine that you're implying that. That is an important thing to be able to say, but it's also important to be able to do what needs to be done. This is where parenting is a very interesting thing to look at, because I've worked with them. I've done a lot of family life education, too, and people are interested in optimism vis-a-vis their children, as they should be, because there are some studies that show that the primary way children get optimistic is they learn it from their parents, especially from their mom, although I keep watching the research to see if that might change, because now that society has changed and people are spending more time with both parents or dads are taking on primary nurturing roles, I think that's going to shift to kids learn their optimism from their primary nurturing person. But we'll see.
Makes sense.
I could be wrong. But
it makes a lot of sense.
Optimistic kids take more risks, and they're more willing to, you know, kind of try again. And yet we've all read about how American kids are kind of delusionally optimistic. You know, they say that they're going to be really high scoring on tests of math and science, and yet maybe they aren't, you know. So it's a complicated situation in the United States, because we want to raise kids with optimism, but we don't want to give them empty boosterism. You can be anything you want. You can do anything you want. It's something I've heard many parents say to children. And you know what? That's not true. If I don't have a gift for languages, I may not be able to be a translator. If I've got nothing for numbers, and maybe I'm not even interested in them, I probably won't make a very good engineer. So I'm not sure how it got started that American parents started to say things that are incredibly optimistic, and I use incredibly advisedly, because it does often come off more like empty boosterism than the kind of authentic optimism that we know leads to, you know, better performance in school and the kind of resilience that you and I are interested in, Lauren.
Right. And you know, it's funny, I always think of the words balance. That's just something I put out there to our listeners, too. It's about balancing. And also, I think it's about learning your strengths. I mean, don't you think an optimist could say, you know, I now I'm learning what my strengths are. I know what my strengths are, and that's what I'm going to focus on. Some research even says don't pay any attention to your weaknesses as much as you can. You just want to really enhance those strengths, and maybe someone else can take care of the things for you in your life or that are weaknesses, or maybe you can find a way not to have them anymore or something.
Well, I think parents do their children a great favor when they let them pursue a series of passions. What you see sometimes is that a child has a passion and then the parent locks in on that and says, oh, this one's the soccer player. Oh, that one is the social butterfly. That's kind of a mistake, too, because although you want to encourage your soccer player, what if that kid later develops an interest in poetry or is ready to leave soccer behind and focus more on being a musician? But now, to please the parents, they are the soccer player. Do you know what I mean? So parents have to be about pulling out their kids' strengths but not marrying themselves to a strength or an interest, because children are going to try on different opportunities as they grow up, and parents can support that or lock them into a role that can become very constricting.
That's so funny you say that, because, you know, I don't have children. I have a four-legged child, as you know. She is the love of my life, my dog. And it's so funny you say that, because I know I read some information on this a while ago, and we have a lot of kids that grew up here in my neighborhood. And it's really funny, because for, I bet it's been a couple of years now, there's two girls. One of them is more athletic. One of them is more, you know, pretty princess girl. And anytime I get the urge, I'll say, you are so pretty and smart with a great personality. Like I always throw all three or four things in with each kid. So they know I'm just not looking at the pretty. I'm just, you know, we're just not looking at the smart or the athletic. I always throw a couple of other things in there, which they do have. I'm not making it up.
Right.
I do that just to sort of balance it out. It's funny. I do that with every kid now.
I think it's a good thing, because we want to support keep kids' gifts, but we don't want to lock them into roles. And actually, if our listeners are interested in children and optimism, Seligman has written a book that's classic. It's not new, but that it shouldn't be rejected because it isn't new, because the way we bring children up doesn't really change that much, because brains really don't change that much.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we have, you know, different kinds of phones and more technology than when he wrote the book. But in terms of teaching kids interpersonal skills, it's still very solid. And it's called The Optimistic Child. And he and his graduate students developed a curriculum that they ran elementary school age kids through. And these kids came to an after school program that they were invited into by the guidance counselor or the principal, or maybe the child had a death of a grandparent or had recently moved, so the kid was under a lot of stress and the parent wanted them to get these optimism skills. And so they taught kids optimism skills, and that's what's cool about the book, is that parents could skim through that book and get lots of ideas for how to avoid boosterism and do things that are actually helpful, skill building. And then they tested the kids after they weren't in the class anymore, because anybody can get a temporary bump. Oh, yeah, the kid's more optimistic because they just finished a skills class. But a year later, they were still using those optimism skills. So that book was one of the things that guided me in how I spoke with my own kids.
Well, that's wonderful. And, you know, we're talking a lot here about parenting. I'm sure our listeners, many of them have children. But what about the corporate world? How do we teach or bring out optimism in the workplace?
Well, that's actually fascinating. I have so many good clients, and most of the people that hire me to do emotional intelligence training, and then optimism is an emotional intelligence competence. So these are organizations that are deliberate in wanting to be classy organizations that are employers of choice and that have a good culture. And so at least one big company that I work for, everybody who's hired gets trained in emotional intelligence, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the reasons that optimism is a good thing in the workplace, as long as, again, it's authentic optimism, is that people get exhausted in meetings where they're trying to solve problems and there are these naysayers. Oh, that'll never work. We tried that. It's too expensive. And there are certain people who think their whole mission in life is to be the devil's advocate, and they're proud of it. But the way they're experienced by others is like Captain Bring Down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So people dread meetings. They kind of mentally check out at meetings. They're looking at their emails under the phone because there he goes again is happening. Whereas a person who is a leader or even just an influential member of a team, it doesn't have to be the facilitator of the team, who can say, look, I know this is a big problem and all of us wish it hadn't happened. But, you know, look around this room. We got a lot of talent and brains here, and I feel confident that if we bring our usual energy and gifts to this problem, we're going to solve it. It's more of a, like, push up your sleeves and jump in mentality. And optimistic people are also more willing to say, okay, have you spoken your full mind? Or who has doubts about this? They're not afraid to hear what might go wrong because they're optimistic that they're big enough to handle whatever comes. So there's a way in which realism gets introduced into problem-solving meetings, but it's not that crushing, depressing, naysaying that just wears people out.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have experienced that, and there's been so much research done it with happiness at work as well that I've been looking at. That it's so important. That workplace is everything. I mean, let's face it.
Time there, right? I mean, we're all in the workplace so much, and companies need their people to be present mentally and physically. They need them to be nimble and not stressed up to the eyeballs. Research shows that when people are overly stressed, creativity is one of the first abilities that kind of takes a walk. Optimism, you can see how optimism fits into all that. Actually, let me tell you one study that was just fascinating. It was done by a business professor, and he brought in a group of people on a weekend to solve a complex problem. They had an hour to solve it. It was solvable. And he put them in teams, and each person who was on the team that solved the problem before the end of the hour was going to win $100. So people were highly motivated because they were going to get paid $100 an hour, basically, just to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And then he videotaped the teams working on the problem. What they didn't know was that he hired actors to artificially insert into half the teams, and the actors had been instructed to act like jerks, like that'll never work, or what a dumb idea, or to act like depressives and say things like whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And he felt that people in an hour experienced what many teams experience over months or even years, because the teams with the actors in them were 40% less productive than the teams who were just four regular folks. They weren't stars or anything. They were just regular folks. And because he was videotaping them, he was able to see that by the end of the hour, one table, the actor had put his head down on the table with his arms crossed and just given up completely on the problem. By the end of the hour, the other three members of his team had their heads down on the table.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Isn't that fascinating?
Wow. I guess it isn't that surprising, but... You know, wow, that's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when you talk about your corporate work, do you find differences? I know you work with nonprofits and women's groups and lots of different nonprofits. Are there differences there, or how do your nonprofits work versus corporate?
I couldn't speak to that, actually, because I think people are people, meetings are meetings, and I've been asked to do this many times in healthcare, for example. Because anybody who's solving problems, working with the public, you know, trying to do more with less, which is most organizations now, can all benefit from authentic optimism skills. And when you train a whole group at one time, a whole department, or you systematically train everyone in a company, then you get this kind of critical mass where when somebody says something that's not realistic but is truly pessimistic in a gathering, they can call each other on it. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So, okay, is that optimistic or is that pessimistic? Let's just think about that. How are we feeling about that right now? And people have language for it, I suppose, is part of what I'm trying to say. The same thing's true with emotional intelligence. Once people understand what an amygdala hijack is, it's funny how they start to use that language when they can feel themselves like going over the edge. It's very empowering.
Well, when you know what to do, then you're cognizant of it and aware of it, and then there's where the changes happen.
Exactly. I mean, there's that moment of choice. Maybe on the tip of my tongue is, well, we tried that already, it won't work, but, you know, we've all been practicing our optimism skills, so I say, okay, I don't want to sound like a pessimist, but we have tried something like that, and it didn't work. So how is this different? See how that would be a way better
different
question?
That sounds much better.
It doesn't it? And mm-hmm. people are a lot less likely to want to run for the hills when people are communicating in that way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, Kim, I'd like to take a minute. I know you are in the midst, very exciting endeavor that you're writing a book. And yeah. I'd love to for you to just tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, my corporate work has been in emotional intelligence focused all these years, and that has been a joy. And I'm still fully engaged in that. But my avocation for the last many, many years has been facilitating poetry circles. And some people hear that and go, poetry circles? A corporate trainer who does poetry circles? But that's because so many of us are afraid of poetry. The only experience we have is the one that we had in school that sometimes was great. Many teachers try very hard to make poetry accessible, but for a lot of people, apparently, it left a bad taste in their mouth. The book that I'm actually working on, two books. One is on how to facilitate poetry circles for personal growth. And I've been leading a group for more than 5 years now. About 80 people are on the email list, and they rotate in and out. We get 20 to 30 at any particular gathering. People come in saying, I don't know why I'm here. My friend brought me. My daughter brought me. I don't know anything about poetry. I had a men's group one time that said, what did you get us into? You know, so-and-so. But after we do mindful reading of these poems, which I carefully choose to be accessible but not preachy, you know, so that there's lots of room in there for reflection, discussion, consolation, and disturbance, you know. After we've done that for a couple of these poems and time to go, people will say, when can we do this again?
One woman, oh, I love it.
I do, too. I never get tired of hearing that. One woman said, I thought my book group was the best conversation on the planet, but this was even better than that. That was one of my highest compliments. So we're looking at poems mostly by modern poets, but modern poets who are writing in order to be understood. In other words, it's not so autobiographical that you don't know what they're talking about. And we mm-hmm. pick themes like what does it mean to be grateful, or in the winter I try to pick things that take a look at all the seasons of our lives, you know. Poets are like prophets. They have a lot to say, and once they let go of the poem, then it's ours, and then we have a lot to say.
Right. Well, it sounds very fascinating. I can't wait till it's ready and comes out, and
Thank you.
Of luck in that endeavor.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to just say people can visit wordspa.net, wordspa.net, if they want to get a sense for what that ministry is like. And then very soon we'll be putting up many poems on grief and loss, because people have asked me to do that. Social workers and people who minister in churches and so on are saying, we know poetry is powerful at those liminal times in people's lives, but we don't have a million hours to read them. Could you put some greatest hits up that would help us make a hospital visit or at a wake? And so by the end of the year, that will be up.
Well, that's really necessary work. I mean, a lot of people just don't know what to do in those scenarios. And plus, then when you put emotions and feelings in there, it really gets complicated. So that's a wonderful resource to have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Poems help you hold complexity. I think maybe the emotional intelligence work I do and the poetry work isn't all that far apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Well, you know, Kim, I'd like to wrap up with the last question for our listeners. Let's say we've got some listeners and people out there who say, you know what, I hear what you're saying. I know it's lowers my stress. We did mention that. Mm-hmm. But if we were trying to talk to somebody about being more optimistic, mm-hmm. I know that there are great things that can happen to you physically mm-hmm. and mentally if you are more optimistic. In wrapping up, can you speak to those things that might be able to, while we're being optimistic, what can happen to our body, mind, and soul?
Yes. Well, okay. Interestingly enough, work done with octogenarians and even people who are between 80 and 100, asking them, what do you think has contributed to your longevity? What advice do you have for us younger ones? Optimism almost always comes out on those lists. So isn't that fascinating?
Wow.
And in terms of what it does for us, you know, we know now, we always suspected that stress, you know, shortens life. But now we know on every level that stress speeds up the process of bringing on whatever is going to ultimately, you know, make us cash in the chips. So without being maudlin, nobody's going to live forever. And if we are stressed up to the eyeballs all the time, the coronary complaint that might claim our life someday is going to manifest itself earlier than if we, you know, are pretty healthy, eat right, and it turns out if we're optimistic. So some of the optimism research has actually been done with people who have heart disease. I'm sure you've heard of type A and type B and all that. That's become more nuanced since that was first proposed by a famous cardiologist, because he noticed how many of his patients, his heart patients, had this constant sense of urgency and impatience and so on. So one of the things we know now is it's not how busy you are that makes you stressed. If you're busy with things you love or are passionate about or believe in deeply, you can manage your stress pretty well if you have good optimism, positive self-talk, and good problem-solving skills, etc. It's that kind of glowering, negative, don't waste my time, you know, impatience and urgency that it turned out contributed to heart disease. So it's not the stress so much as the way you handled stress, what you tell yourself about the stress. And when you're under a lot of stress, you are often talking to yourself pessimistically. So when you're pessimistic, you're saying things and thinking things that lead to these mini fight-or-flight episodes, which eventually take a toll on your body. Whereas if you can say to yourself, okay, it always takes time to make friends in a new job, and I made friends at my last job, and I'll make friends at this one too, you're not going to have as many or as big stress episodes as somebody who's saying, taking this new job was a mistake, I don't have anybody to eat lunch with today, everybody's going to think I'm an idiot. Do you hear the difference, like the difference in the emotional tenor of that? And a
Definitely.
Lifetime of that second way of talking to yourself really does contribute to physical wear and tear on the body. And it's not later in life only. It starts early. We know now that things that are going to manifest as ulcers and, you know, pretty bad health concerns in people's 40s, 50s, and 60s are already getting started in their 20s and 30s.
Right. Well, these are pretty profound reasons, you know, why we should be more optimistic. And I'm going to look at my score and hope that I can raise that up a little better from moderately to a little bit higher. But
I'm optimistic that both of us can keep raising our scores as the decades go by.
Yeah. That's the goal there. So, you know, those are really good reasons to want to do it. And, you know, on the show, we're going to continue talking about optimism throughout the rest of our show today. It's an important topic. Really, you can change the way you talk, and it'll help you change the way you think. And then that translates into feeling better mentally, physically, and in every way, really, mentally, physically, in your heart, soul, however you want to look at it. So, Kim, it has been wonderful to have you. I really, really appreciate it. And I do want to tell our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about Kim Langley, first of all, you can visit her corporate webpage at www.kimlangley, and that's L-A-N-G-L-E-Y, kimlangley.net. Or you can visit her other site at www.lifebalanceenterprises.com, and that's lifebalanceenterprises.com. Kim, any last-minute thoughts or anything else you'd like to add?
Gratitude and optimism go together, and I'm very grateful that you invited me to be on the show, Lori. Thanks.
Oh, very much so, Kim. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Want to find a space to participate in reading, activities, interactive blog, and much more? Check out www.happinesshangout.net. Looking for a speaker or workshop around the area of happiness? We customize presentations to fit your needs. Just click on the My Services tab at the website. You can also support the site by shopping at Amazon or one of our other affiliates. Just go to www.happinesshangout.net and click on the shopping link or go to my page here at BBS Radio. Well, hi, everyone. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed Miss Kim Langley talk about optimism. I know I really learn a lot from her every time that we speak. She's a wonderful human being, and she does wonderful work. So again, if you would like to reach her, she's at kimlangley.net, and her last name is spelled L-A-N-G-L-E-Y. Or you can also visit her other website at www.lifebalanceenterprises.com. So we want to continue talking about optimism for the rest of the show. And what I've learned in research is that optimism does so many good things for you. I also learned, and I'm pleased about, that I'm one of those people who always say, what's the worst case scenario? And then often I'll say, I can deal with that. And I may have mentioned that already. I can live with that. And so I feel better about the fact that my score was kind of low on the optimism test. But benefits of being an optimist is increase physical health, which everybody wants. If you don't have good health and you don't feel good, it makes everything else so much more challenging. Also, it brings meaning to your life when you feel better and you can have an optimistic viewpoint. And it lowers your stress, anxiety, and depression, which are very prevalent things, especially if you're in the U.S. We hear about it a lot, and there's a lot of medication and other kinds of work being done to lower depression that's non-medical related or non-pill related, I might say, as well. Also, when you think about your workplace, I mean, if you've got to be there, you might as well be more productive and feel better. And the way to do it is just to kind of look at things a little bit different way, even if it's in small increments. And sometimes you just don't feel like it. But I find when I do it, it just makes my day better. So hopefully you got a lot out of that. As we continue on, I want to speak just a little bit to learned optimism. We talked a little bit in with Ms. Langley about learned optimism and Martin Seligman, who is considered the father of positive psychology. And I was very interested to read that I teach principles of interviewing and counseling, and one of the branches of psychology we teach are cognitive psychology. And one of the theories is called social learning. And what it says is probably something that you all already know, all the listeners already know, that we mimic people that we're around, especially as kids. We are looking at whoever raised us, mom, dad, grandparents, aunts, uncles, wherever you were raised. And we develop a lot of their habits. We develop a lot of the things they say, do, and maybe even we begin to feel the way they feel because we're grown up around that. We're in that environment. And that's called social learning. If you are out there looking for a role model, you might sort of become more attached or have a friendship with somebody that you want to emulate, or people who are kind of insecure and maybe not really sure about themselves will look for those kind of people and pick up their habits, talk the way they do, act the way they do. And that's really social learning. So do the people in your life, are they more optimistic or pessimistic? And that's a really interesting thought, something to really ponder. You know, am I the way I am because of the way I was raised, the people I've put in my life on purpose, or those that just land there in my life, and I've just allowed them to sort of affect me? And that's something that is really interesting, because you know, sometimes we have people that suck the life out of us, and those are the people that that oftentimes we realize, well, maybe I have to pull back a little bit because I'm not feeling as good as I normally do when I'm around those people. So I guess I'd throw some questions out. I guess I'd like our listeners to think a little bit about this and think about, first of all, am I more glass half empty or glass half full? Am I more of an optimist or a pessimist? Do I look at things in a hopeful manner, or is am I always expecting the worst? Do I say, of course it's going to go wrong, I know it's going to go wrong? Do I look at it in a more permanent way? Do I completely think when something happens, it's a big disaster? And those are kind of the ways to tell. So when you grew up, what kind of words and perceptions and environment did you grow up in? Was it more optimistic or more pessimistic? And the big question is, how has that affected how you've become today? And so if we can certainly take callers right now and kind of hear what you have to say, maybe what our guest speaker had to say, or if you like to talk a little bit about optimism, pessimism, or how you grew up, we'd love to hear from you. I can tell you right out, I've talked to some people and I interviewed some people around my life and we talked about it. And we realized, you know, we come from a part of the country that's very, it's the Midwest. Now, where I grew up was almost the East, but it's still in Ohio and very hardworking steel town. Everybody, lots of people worked in the steel mills and it was that kind of town. And the mantra was kind of like, well, work hard, play later. Good times come few and far between. So when they're here, you better like them and enjoy them because they don't come back too often. That's the kind of sort of mindset it was. And it's not that we didn't have fun, not that we didn't laugh, but a lot of times we were laughing at the fact that things were going wrong, which is probably kind of an optimistic trait, but things were probably going to go wrong and things were going to be hard. Because I think our parents' grew up that way. Many of them, you know, didn't start out living in the country that they ended up in. In my case, it's the United States. They came over from Eastern Europe. And so it was one of those things where I know I thought very optimistically. And I know when I speak to myself, I would say, Lori, that is so dumb. Lori, I can't believe you did that. Oh, you shouldn't have done that. And you feel like, you know, over the time, I've done a lot of reading and researched and you know, worked on myself in a lot of these areas. And I came back, when I start to do that, I immediately pull back. Now I'm almost to the point when even word one comes into my head. I pull that right back. So you know, you think about yourself and how you grew up and how you came to be the way you are. And maybe think about pulling back on that self-talk a little bit if it's negative. And just say, you know what? I've dealt with this before. This is no big deal. This is just life. And I can handle anything. And I found that really, really has helped my stress level. So, again, feel free to call if you'd like to, or just listen in. Happy to have it. I do want to mention to you, if you want to take the optimism test, we do have it. It's a really long website. So it might be easier to just go on whatever search engine you want to go in and basically type in optimism test and put it, or you can put in HTTP, /, web.stanford.edu. And hopefully there's a search button and you can put in optimism test. It's really cool because the questions aren't what you think they'd be. They're not easy. You can't fix the test. I thought, oh, I'll probably end up fixing this thing because I'll know how to answer the questions, but you don't. And in the end, it calculates for you where you are. And like I said, and with Kim, I'm moderately optimistic. I do a lot of that. I do a lot of that in my life. So I'm not sure where the other areas are, but hey, you know, we'll work on it is what we'll basically do. So check that out. Also, there's some really cool stuff at brainpickings.org if you'd like to get involved in that. So what else do we want to talk about today to finish this great topic out? Well, a couple other things to ponder is, what kind of mindset do you have from watching others? Have you ever watched others and had maybe a different kind of mindset than you thought you would, and you've become different over the years? I know I have quite a bit. And I really think that's a lot from reading and researching. And obviously, I wanted to go in that direction. And I will tell you, from a person that can say it right here to the listeners, I feel so much better than I used to as a kid. Even as a young adult, I feel way better. When things happen in my life, I find that I can just deal with them so much better. And I've quite frankly gone through a lot personally. I've dealt with death. My loved one has dealt with death, dealt with loss of jobs by choice, but a loss of job is a loss of job. And it can be a huge transition and some other things too. And when you can get through things like that pretty well, you think, you know what, I think I'm onto something here. So I really hope that, you know, that you think about that and maybe, you know, do a little research about it and think to yourself, you know, maybe I could just be a little nicer to myself when I talk to myself. Maybe I just put that smile on my face and say, hey, life is really good. I got a good place to sleep, a good place to be. I have food on the table. You know, if you like your job, great. If you don't, that's lots of other shows down the road. We're going to have a lot to talk about on the Happiness Hangout about relationships and happiness and work and happiness and gratitude and how it affects happiness and so many other amazing things with the guests that we're going to be having throughout our shows. So hopefully you can listen in and learn lots of great stuff. If you wanted to read a little bit more about optimism, you can go to my blog at happinesshangout.net. Just go to the blog and I have a blog on optimism and we can continue talking about that on the blog. And that's a great place to be. And there's all kinds of other great topics there if you would like to do that. And we hope that you do. So what else do we want to finish with? So you're thinking about what have you adopted from watching other people? So you think about that. What would you change to have a healthier mindset? So in other words, if you do the worst case scenario, hopefully you think you can always handle that. If you think you can't handle the worst case scenario, it's good to really think that through or talk to somebody about that because you don't want to be in a situation where you think you can't handle it. I always suggest, you know, talking to a valued friend or if you, you know, do work with a counselor or a therapist to work with them, you know, on those things. If life looks like it's very dooming, which typically, you know, most things, pretty much all things, we get through the worst of the worst. And we find that we bounce back easier than we thought we will. Or that we ever could. And so sometimes we have to give ourselves more credit. So, you know, say those things to yourself that say, hey, I can get through this. I can get through this day. If you don't, you know, love the work that you're doing, but you like someone at work, you focus on that. If you love the work you're doing, but don't like people around you, focus on the work that you're doing. I mean, really, we can change ourselves just a little bit throughout the day. So hope that you do that. If you are looking for some other resources, there's a ton on optimism. I've given you some of those already. Hopefully you can check those out. PositivePsychologyProgram.com/learned-optimism. Again, PositivePsychologyProgram.com/learned-optimism is great articles and information on optimism if you want to get into that a little bit more. My website, which is happinesshangout.net, has tons of resources in the happiness areas. And what we're looking to do is just raise the happiness level and well-being level in a way that makes people more happy in life, more comfortable in life, feel their best. And that's really what we're trying to do here. So check out the website. Excited to do the radio show here. Going to be coming to you every other Wednesday with a different topic. We're going to have something around happiness and well-being every week that's hopefully a learning experience that you can relate to. And hopefully you really get a lot out of the show and love to have you here. So thanks for joining us on our first inaugural Happiness Hangout show. We are so excited to present this and to continue presenting it. Listen to us every other week at Wednesday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 6 Mountain, 7 Central, and 8 Eastern. Thanks again. The Happiness Hangout signing out for the week. Want to find a space to participate in reading, activities, interactive blog, and much more? Check out www.happinesshangout.net. Looking for a speaker or workshop around the area of happiness? We customize presentations to fit your needs. Just click on the My Services tab at the website. You can also support the site by shopping at Amazon or one of our other affiliates. Just go to www.happinesshangout.net and click on the shopping link or go to my page here at BBS Radio.